Good. Well, welcome back, friends. We are continuing through Genesis in the sixth chapter today as we make our way into the flood story. You'll remember yesterday that we saw the conclusion of kind of the preface to the Noah story, where God had looked upon the earth, saw that humans' hearts were full of sin, that, remember this language, every inclination of the thoughts of their heart was only evil all the time. And the Lord was grieved. A very profound verse, a very profound introduction to a story that we often attribute some emotions like anger to God, confidence maybe. It is rare in the scripture that a negative type emotion like sadness would be attributed to the Lord. But here, God's heart is grieved. And so where that leads God is where we pick up the story today in verse 7. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I've created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground, the birds of the air, for I am grieved that I made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So here we have the preface to the story. God, because he is grieved, says, I'm just done with them. They've had this run and it has gone downhill and it is now at the bottom. It is bad. What I created good has now become a thing that hurts me to my core, that grieves me to my heart. And I'm just going to push the reset switch and be done with it. And then there is this kind of a bridge verse or a connector verse, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And it's interesting in that we're told that fact before we're told anything about Noah, which is an interesting way to tell a story.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to tell a story, and it's maybe an interesting way to soften what's otherwise a not very soft text here. I mean, let's not rush past the uncomfortable nature of where we've just been, but the very God who made chapter 1, chapter 2, is now speaking about destroying that very creation and the beings within it. We're just now in the beginning of chapter 6. This is really the question that has been raised ever since chapter 3. Once we get to sin and this brokenness that's been unleashed into the world, the resulting and natural question is, what's God going to do about it? And as we see that sin has progressed, as we spoke about yesterday, we now see it embedded in a society, in an entire world. God now identifies the only solution to this problem to be the one of complete destruction. To get rid of the problem is going to require killing those who bear this sin. And this is a very, very, very difficult text. I mean, even as we see it from the side of the New Testament, I mean, the fact that this is the extent to which God would have to go to solve the problem of sin is, this is a shocking kind of thing. And it is, it's worth bearing out some of that with us as we go into this story, because it only gets darker really as the story goes along.
Agreed, Michael. And such is the extent of the sin that it not only affects mankind, you would expect God to say, so I'm going to exterminate mankind. Right. But here God says that it has spilled into the whole creation. Mankind as the sort of crown jewel of creation. Remember the story, particularly that first chapter, that everything is created in order and finally man and woman are created and it is very good. Now their fall has taken all of creation with it. The birds, the animals, I'm going to get rid of all of it. And so we have brought the world down in our sin. We've brought the world down with us, with this one exception of the man named Noah. And I want to point out as we move into this story, unlike Genesis 1 and 2, unlike Genesis 1 and 2, the first story and the second story, where we have two different accounts, And they honored that by keeping them in different chapters. When we get to the Noah story, we still see two different stories. We see them put together. So one of the easiest ways to keep track of that is when you see the word God versus when you see the Lord. And you will notice that in the early part of this story, we've been using Lord in all capitals, which is Yahweh, the Hebrew sacred name for God. And then as we switch verses, you'll see that we move to Elohim, or which what is translated God. And unlike those early parts of Genesis where they separated the family stories into first chapter and second chapter, here they kind of mash them together. So we go from verse 8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord, to verse 9. This is an account of Noah, and we change sources here. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And so the most important, the single determining characteristic of Noah in this story is that he's righteous, that he alone walked with God, blameless among the people of his time. We've already seen this preface that all of humankind was sinful all the time, but Noah stands out as righteous. And righteous is a significantly important and powerful word in the context of the story.
Of the story, and ultimately it will be of the entire book of Genesis, actually, because there is none found righteous, right? This is why God is looking to bring this kind of destruction. And so he sees Noah. Before I run to that, though, Clint, I wanted to point out, to the same point that you made, a careful reader here is going to have moments not only where you see the name of God shift, you're also going to have moments where you recognize that there's a kind of repetitive nature to the text. And if you ever get to a point and you say, man, this sounds like a repeat of something I've heard previously, it often is. If you look up a little ways, you're going to often find a different way of saying the same exact thing that you just encountered. That's another version of what Clint was just describing, the ways in which you see these stories are brought together. And sometimes biblical scholarship may not make biblical study incredibly accessible. In other words, it may feel like, well, why does that matter? I do think it matters here, because you're going to see, if you read these stories carefully, how they've been laid on top of each other. Though they're telling us the same story, they're bringing very different perspectives and vantages that the authors believed were important enough to keep together to allow that tension to exist. And so it's worth keeping attuned to that as we go throughout this story, because, and what we want to make this clear, what God is doing here in the flood is substantial. I mean, this is a kind of recreative moment that we're not going to see again. God doesn't command this kind of natural destruction at this scale anywhere else. Maybe you look to the book of Revelation, but that nowhere, at least in the Old Testament, do you see God working at this scale, and you see it now within these first six chapters of Genesis. So, pay attention to how these stories have been laid onto each other as we go together over the next few, I guess it'll be into next week. Because I think it's really interesting how they share those different perspectives of this pivotal text.
And there are people for whom this is problematic, the fact that there's clearly two streams coming together here, and that in some cases, even the details may repeat one another, or in a couple of instances, they may challenge one another, though in not very, I would say, substantial ways. But I would say, rather than be troubled by that, I think it offers us a chance to see a different perspective. Clearly, they're telling the same story, but from slightly different vantage points and from slightly different layers of what they find most important. And I think it doesn't have to distract us. I actually think that it can help us. So we get one of those repetitive details right now. Verse 11, Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on the earth had corrupted their ways. So again, this is this story's way of telling us that God sees no path forward with the world that doesn't involve destruction. God sees no way around a kind of cataclysmic punishment upon the wickedness of humankind, that so far has their fall been that they're really, to use a loaded word from the New Testament, it's really irredeemable. And it must be punished. It must be dealt with. There must be a consequence. And so God says to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence. Because of them, I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. And that's kind of where we'll draw the line today. But it doesn't necessarily get us to a different place. But here it's conversation with Noah. Noah is much more in the circle than in the first story where he says, oh, yeah, everybody but Noah. Here it's Noah is the one to whom God reveals the plan ultimately. And we get to the same place by the same path, corruption and violence and a righteous man who will be saved. Because one of the things we learn about God's character in this story is that God will honor righteousness, that God will hold. Michael, is that you?
I'm here.
Okay, we had a crazy, like a vacuum cleaner going on. That God will honor righteousness. And that's, again, a very significant part of this story.
It may be. Rochelle is practicing viola right now, so maybe you're hearing viola in the basement.
This was like static or noise. Maybe it was just on my end.
Well, so I'll add in here, Clint. Back to that point of righteousness that you made. This is maybe a part of Noah's story. It's possible you don't know. It comes at the very end. But it's important for you to recognize that when we encounter Noah, who verse 9, Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. That is at best an account of Noah and his current standing, not an eternal statement of Noah's character. Noah's going to make some very clear missteps in his story here in Genesis. And it's clear when God looks upon the righteousness of humanity, he looks upon that righteousness conditionally. God knows that there's no perfect human. There's none who lives with unstained life. And that is ultimately the thread of scripture we see fulfilled in Jesus Christ. From a New Testament reading of this text, what Noah could have never been was the permanent solution. But yet God has conditionally chosen this one by grace because God has seen a righteousness that lives within him. But the point I'm making right now is that this righteousness is not an eternal one. Noah does not stand out in history as one who is not blotted by sin. If you hold on to the end of Noah's story, you're going to find out that he too is scarred by the same sinfulness that actually lives on the other side of the flood. So there's none who escapes the want of righteousness, yet Noah is seen to be righteous as in relation to those who surrounded him. Is that fair, Clint?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Michael. We want to not read righteousness here through the lens of the New Testament. We read it through the lens of that previous phrase that he walked with God, that while no one else honored God in their life, that while everyone else let themselves lead them to selfishness and violence, as we saw in Cain, that has now become the rule for all humanity, with the exception of Noah. And so Noah stands out as righteous in that he continues to look to God for direction, as opposed to all of his peers. This is not a theological statement, I think, as much as it's a practical statement.
Yeah, that's good. Well, friends, thanks for being with us. I'd say tomorrow is an interesting text in that it is the sort of nitty-gritty of putting together an arc, and there's some interesting conversation to be had in that. So I hope you join us for that.
Thanks for being with us, everybody.
We'll see you tomorrow.